Now we'll introduce our speaker. Kate Lohr is an ordained UU minister who retired last fall from her job as social justice minister at First Unitarian Church of Portland after 18 years of service. She now serves West Hills Fellowship, that's us, as community minister and spends her days directing Home Free, a county domestic and sexual violence intervention program of the Volunteers of America. Kate is a wife, mother, and grandmother with a deep love for people, politics, and the planet. Kate?
No humans have ever before been in the exact position we find ourselves now. For you and I and all of us are standing on a precipice of a very uncertain future. We've got an unpredictable president in the White House, someone who changes course on what seems like a daily basis. And we're being told to prepare for the worst cuts to health and human services that our country has ever known. And then there's all the saber rattling going on with North Korea, and with it, steep increases in military spending and talk of nuclear war. We have a job market that's been changing so rapidly that good paying jobs are disappearing, as is any certainty that there'll always be Social Security. I mean, even the future of our denomination seems uncertain. Most of you know that the president of our denomination just quit suddenly, along with some key staff members, and no one knows what General Assembly is going to be like when it gathers next month. And of course, we're all facing that mother of uncertainties, climate change. Yes, we know that it's begun, but we cannot predict the rate of change nor how bad it's going to get. So in many ways, it feels like we're teetering on the edge of a possible disaster, circling round and round the type of maelstrom described by Edgar Allan Poe. We can feel ourselves getting sucked towards disaster, but we don't know what to do about it. Do we devote ourselves to resistance or to beauty? Do we stay current with the latest breaking news, or do we protect ourselves from it? Do we draw upon history and what's worked before, or do we try something altogether new? Allow me to begin addressing these questions by telling you another story. It's a story of a man who is living a long and happy life on a beautiful Mediterranean island, or maybe it was like Fiji. Now, he and his family have lived on this island for generations, making their homes here and earning their livelihoods here. And because of this, he absolutely loves his homeland. Now, as the years pass, this man grows older until at last he realizes that the end of life is approaching. Metaphor alert. Before dying, though, he asks his son to take him outside one last time. So he does. And once outside, the man kneels down, gathers a handful of island soil, clutches it tightly in his gnarled hand, and then dies. Now, upon arriving at Heaven's Gate, the man is greeted by angels. They welcome him and invite him in. But when he tries to cross the threshold, he can't. The angels say, "Oh, that's because you cannot enter until you let go of that soil you're still clutching." To which the old man responds, "No, I could never do that. This is my native soil, the earth of my beloved island home." "Oh, well," says the angels, and they leave him to wander alone outside the gate. Well, after a few years, the angels go out to him again, bringing a taste of the heavenly banquet being served inside the gates. They do everything they can to entice him in, and although he really wants to join them, he is still unwilling to let go of the soil he is grasping. So again, the angels leave him outside the gate. After still more years, the angels return, this time with the old man's granddaughter, who has grown old herself and died. She is so thrilled to see her grandfather that she runs up to him. "Oh, Grandpa," she says, "I'm so happy you're here. Please come and join us in heaven. We love you so much and we want you to be with us." Now, the old man, too, is delighted, so much so that he completely forgets himself. In his joy, he flings out his arms to embrace her, and as he does this, the soil slips from his fingers. And with the single act of letting go, the man is allowed to pass through the gate at long last. And what does he see? He sees the whole of his beloved island waiting for him. So in the end, that unto which he had been clinging was precisely the same thing preventing him from getting what he really wanted, home. Now, I share this story with you this morning, and the other one, too, about the maelstrom, because we are collectively carrying a lot of anxiety about our future. And it's only natural that in response to those anxieties, we try to cling to the familiar and to the past. But no matter how much we want things and relationships and our ideas of a better future to stay the same, nothing in life ever does. It's called impermanence, and there's no escaping it. Change is simply a part of life. Sometimes the change is for the better, sometimes it's not. But no matter why things are changing, life consistently and insistently calls us to let go and move on. Even though it's hard, even though it's scary and seems impossible at times. Sometimes we must simply let go of all we know, all we feel, all we have, and take a leap of faith into a dark, unknown abyss. It's an immense task, which explains why all the world's religions and spiritual traditions offer teachings about it. I'll lift up just a few. In the Christian, Jewish, and Muslim traditions, we are taught that at such times, we are required to give it all up to God, Yahweh, or Allah in prayer. We must act for the common good, yes, and help one another, but ultimately we must learn to acknowledge that some things are beyond our control. Reinhold Niebuhr's Serenity Prayer is an example of this type of approach to uncertainty. You'll remember it. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. In Buddhism and Hinduism, we are encouraged to practice detachment. This is because attachment, its opposite, is considered the root of all suffering. And so we develop practices of living in the moment, of letting go of any desire for things to be other than they are. And in doing so, we're taught, this not only helps us find peace, it opens up our minds to the possibilities that surround us always. Like the brother who survived the maelstrom by observing that the heavy things were sinking faster than light things, and who thus discovered that he must let go of the boat and allow himself to be saved by becoming buoyant. Now, these spiritual teachings have comforted people for countless generations, but do they still apply? I mean, how can we possibly be detached or serene when our very future is at stake? Well, what I'd like to suggest is that figuring out what to do is only half of the equation, and it's the one that Tracy addressed so well in her Earth Day sermon. Anybody here for that? It was a great sermon. You'll remember that she reminded us that we must keep figuratively throwing rocks and sticks into the river to change its course. We have to keep on voting, gardening, resisting, and creating community. But today, you can consider this a companion piece. I want to focus on the other half of the equation, figuring out how to be. Do versus be. For when we solely focus on what to do, we are immediately drawn into fix-it mode. And in order to fix anything, one has to feel fairly certain about what the problem really is, as well as some certainty about the likely outcome. But certainty will not save us. For example, I don't know about you, but I was fairly certain that educating people about economics, politics, and science would help us avert the dangers we now face. But boy, I was wrong. People are more complex than that, proving that both my analysis and my solution were wrong. My certainty failed me. And what I'd like to suggest this morning is that hanging on to the boat will not serve us anymore. We're going to have to let go and jump into the abyss. I'm hoping that by doing so, we'll all be able to float. Now, let me ground these concepts with a personal example. One of the things that I've always been attached to is the notion that I could be a perfect parent for my children. I know, it sounds crazy. I get that. Still, I was raised in the 60s and 70s, a time when social scientists were telling us that we could shape or even control the way our children turned out if we just did the right things. So early in my life, I promised myself that I would always do the right thing for my kids. Consequently, I read every parenting book on the library shelves. I worked at home, even though it was boring. While they were young, I volunteered in their classroom. I fed them healthy and organic foods. I took them to the library each week and read to them daily. I never let them cry alone and always acknowledged their feelings. I refrained from spanking them even when they were awful. And I gave them access to any type of lesson they would ever want. Investing in my children will be the most important investment in my life, I told myself. And because I did all these perfect parent things, I expected and was, in fact, attached to the idea that I would end up with perfectly happy and well-adjusted children. Sounds reasonable, right? Well, life would soon teach me that there are no such guarantees and that I could never be in complete control of another person's life. In fact, there was a time not that long ago, really, when one of my kids got into deep trouble. Out of respect for him, I'm not going to go into all of the sordid details. I will tell you, though, that my son, who had always been a smart and happy-go-lucky kid, went through one of life's rough patches. His dad walked out of his life. This loss affected him so profoundly that he stopped being happy. He became so depressed and angry and was in such deep pain that neither counseling nor medication or the love of his friends and family could help make the pain go away. So, in order to function, my precious son decided to do, well, what he decided that the only way he could endure the pain was to do what people throughout history have done in the face of deep despair. He tried to numb his pain with drugs. In his case, meth. It was all so totally out of my control. My son began hanging out with some very sketchy people who felt like family to him, he said. Unbeknownst to him, these people had recognized my son's vulnerability. And they were so super nice to him, acting like his best friend and telling him, try this, it'll make you feel better. He took the bait, big time. It didn't take long before my son was so messed up that he could no longer hold down a job. And when he ran out of money, he moved back in with me. You know, it was my hope that if I let him stay with me, I might be able to wield some sort of influence over him. Isn't that a perfect parent kind of rationale? I naively hoped that he'd be able to save himself, or that I would be able to help him save himself. But deep in my heart, I knew that we are both entering a maelstrom of epic proportions. I offered him free access to recovery treatment. He refused. I implored him to be honest with me, that I wasn't there to judge him, but to help him. He lied anyway. He assured me he had it all under control. He didn't. It took a while, but I eventually came to the realization that I could neither take away his pain for him nor force him to make better decisions. Yes, me. The one who was so attached to being a perfect parent had to confront the reality that I had a seriously addicted son and I didn't know what to do about it. Now, perhaps some of you have been in this predicament or one similar to it. Maybe it's a loved one who's refusing to take their meds or has a gambling or alcohol addiction or is in an abusive relationship, or maybe it's you. But the reality is, we all must face maelstroms sooner or later in our lives. And the primary question becomes, are you going to get sucked into the center of the maelstrom by going down with the ship? Or are you going to let it go in order to find something new and unexpected to help you ride through the storm? What I did was I chose to detach from the ship, and by this I mean I kicked my son out of my home, the exact opposite of what perfect parents are supposed to do. I cut off all financial support and told him he couldn't see or communicate with me for 3 months, and then I watched him pack up and leave, knowing that things would almost assuredly go from bad to worse. Moreover, I locked up the house, set the alarm, and headed off to Mexico. I knew that studying and writing by the sea would buoy me and open my mind to new possible solutions. And here's a funny side note. While there, I discovered that there are two kinds of mourning doves that live near the Sea of Cortez. One of them is the same kind we have here. The other one, though, has a very distinct call, and I kid you not when I tell you that it sounds just like this. Let the boy go. Let the boy go. Now, I heard this bird song every morning and every afternoon, and each time I heard it, I used it as a mantra to practice detachment. This doesn't mean that I shoved aside my love or deep concern for my son. Rather, I used it as a means by which to lift up a prayer to this beautiful and hurting child of mine several times a day, while also surrendering myself to the great heart at the center of the universe. Sure, I cried with worry every day, like any mother would, but I also surrounded myself with moments of gratitude and beauty that helped me keep my head above the water. Finally, the 3 months were up. I was home, and I finally saw my son again. And I gotta tell you, he looked so bad, I almost fell over. He had been homeless and was so skinny that he looked like he was dying. And he was dying, I'm sure, both physically and spiritually. I hugged him, of course, but then I didn't know what to do or what to say. As I stood there staring at him, he brought me up short by asking me for a second chance. Now, we've all heard about addicts asking for second chances, right? It's usually an empty promise used to manipulate people and buy time. Was this one of those times? And was I going to let myself get suckered? It all felt so uncertain. And there were no easy answers. All I could think to do was to take some deep breaths and utter a prayer. Spirit of life, come unto me. Buoy me. Guide me. And don't you dare let me go. My son could see that I was struggling. He was struggling too. Then he looked me straight in the eye and told me that this was the only second chance he would ever seek, and that if he didn't get clean, he would never bother me again. So I searched my heart, and I searched his heart. I asked for wisdom from within, and then I took a leap of faith. I believed him. I jumped off that boat and gave him a second chance. That was 4 years ago, and I'm happy to report that my son has been clean ever since. His yes. His anniversary, in fact, is next month on June 26th. He's now financially independent, has a good-paying job that he loves, has a great clean and sober girlfriend, and a whole different set of friends. And I couldn't have anticipated that outcome. It's not the typical trajectory, but it happened. And what I learned, of course, it was that by letting go of my son, that I got him back. And the gates of heaven opened up. Now, since that time, he's thanked me a million times, both for forcing his hand by kicking him up and then for holding his hand as he pieced his life back together, which is what we all need, isn't it? When life serves us tough times and difficult choices, someone to hold our hand and offer support. And this is the primary reason why we gather in this community, to remind each other that we don't have to weather life's storms alone, that whenever we're faced with loss and tragedy and uncertain futures, we can draw comfort, strength, and buoyancy from knowing that we will be upheld and will uphold each other in a loving, buoyant embrace that will not let us go, even as we must let go of any source or sense of certainty. Now, some call this source of buoyancy and support love. Others might call it spirit of life or the wisdom that resides in every intentional community. Others, like Pablo Neruda, might simply call it silence. But it's here, always here, whenever you think to open yourselves up to it. What will happen in our future? We don't yet know. But may each of us here take courage in knowing that we're on this journey together. Life continues to flow on. How can we keep from singing? Amen.
Thank you, Kate, for a wonderful